Welcome to the Stabbin' Stylists Podcast. I'm Randa.
And I'm Ashley.
We are just two stylists who love true crime and hair, and we're going to tell you about both.
This is a true crime podcast. These stories may be disturbing to some. Listener discretion is advised. Hello.
Hey, what y'all doing?
Hopefully washing your hair, because that's what this is about.
So let's talk about the myths about clean versus dirty hair. The number one that I want you to know is that, like, for any special occasion, I don't want your hair, like, greasy dirty. I want you to have shampooed it the night before. I don't want you to shampoo it that morning because I need it very dry to start styling it or whatever. But yeah, I don't come to me with like greasy, dirty hair. Shampoo it the night before.
I just had a conversation at a bridal shower this weekend too of like, y'all, please don't show up with your hair wet to like your wedding hair.
Right, exactly. Like, no, don't do that. No, no, no. We need it dry and semi-clean.
And when your hair is excessively oily and we're putting color over that, it's not going to take as well because it's fighting through that oil. So once again, we don't want you to come with very clean, wet hair to your hair appointment, but shampoo the day before. Please don't come in with your hair
grazed down. Yeah, 1 to 2 days dirty is fine. But yeah, don't come with like a week's worth of buildup on your hair.
If you look at your hair and you're like, ooh, I wouldn't want to dig through this, we wouldn't either. So please keep that in mind.
Thank you. Smelling scalpy. It's time to watch it, sis.
Thanks. Trigger warning. This episode contains graphic crime. All right. Today, I'm going to tell you the story of the fast food murders. The story is going to start February 16th of 1997 at a Captain D's on Lebanon Road in Donelson, Tennessee. Steve and Sarah were prepping for the morning rush. They were getting ready. And Steve was the 25-year-old father of three. He had been working for the franchise since he was 15 and worked his way up from part-time employee to a manager. Sarah had only been working there for about 9 months. She was 16 years old, and she was super involved in all kinds of stuff at school. And she got really, really good grades. So since she was in all these activities and she got such good grades, her mom was super hesitant about letting her work.
Yeah, she was like, don't, if your school starts to waver,
right,
pulling your butt out of there.
But Captain D's was just right down the road and she only, you know, worked a few hours a week. So mom was comfortable with it. She had actually just bought her own car 2 weeks before.
Which, I mean, probably is the reason she wanted a job, right?
Exactly. So at 8:15 that morning, Steve took a phone call from his regional manager. And at 8:54, a woman drove past and saw two men kind of standing in the entryway of the door talking. One man she recognizes, Steve, and the other man was standing in the door holding like a piece of paper. The man had dark hair and was about 5 inches taller than Steve was. But the restaurant wasn't supposed to be open until 10 o'clock yet. Steve let the man into the restaurant, and once he let the man into the restaurant, the man pulls a gun on Steve.
What? Why did Steve let him in? Do we know?
Not yet.
Okay.
We're going to. So he went in, and he empties out all of the safe's contents, and he took Steve and Sarah both to the cooler and had them lay down on the floor. And trigger warning, he pulled the muzzle back to Steve's head and pulled the trigger, shooting him 3 times. Then he's
in the head?
Yes. Then he shot Sarah too.
What, did he shoot Sarah in the head?
Mm-hmm.
You know, shoot her what?
Twice.
Two times.
Yes. So he goes out to the office to get the surveillance tape, and he hears this, like...
Because it's 97, they're going to have...
Cameras. Right. And he hears this, like, clanging sound from the cooler and goes back in there, and Sarah's trying to pull herself up. So he shoots her two more times in the head.
No!
And leaves with the tapes in his hand.
Oh, no.
At 9:30 that morning, a man was driving by and saw a tall, muscular man walking, you know, quickly away from the restaurant.
Oh, walking away from that mug.
Exactly. And the man was, like, averting his eyes, and he got to a parked car and left. Just a few minutes later, the third employee shows up to come to work. They go, they realize the door's locked, they're, you know, looking through the windows, and all the chairs are still on the table. But Steve and Sarah should have been past that point in the opening process.
Right. It should have been pretty much ready to go.
Right. So he goes around, he's banging on the back door, he's banging on the front door, nobody's going to come let him in.
Yeah.
So he drives down, because you've got to remember, this is 97, he didn't just have an iPhone in his pocket.
Right.
So he drove to a business down the street, and he called, and he called, and he called, and he called, and he called. Nobody ever answered.
Well, red flags.
Well, he calls an employee at the restaurant whose dad is a police officer.
Okay.
And it's like, something's up, call your dad. So Nashville police go down there, and when they entered the restaurant, they found the two bodies of Steve and Sarah in the freezer. They realize there's shoe prints on the floor, but there are no fingerprints. Nothing other
than... But the guy's shoe prints are on the floor.
Yes, but no fingerprints.
Okay.
There was $7,000 that had been stolen, $250 in coins.
You took the rolls of coin.
He even took the rolls of coins. Steve's wallet, which had about $600 that was supposed to be his rent money.
Oh, you passed.
Yeah. So the next day on the highway, about 12 miles away, somebody actually ended up finding Steve's wallet. And there was a movie card that had a very distinctive thumbprint on it. But there was no matches. So they were like, well, we have this.
But
right
it wasn't
now.
His thumbprint.
It wasn't Steve's.
Okay.
But it was a very, you could tell this was a very outline. So they had a very good thumbprint.
So it was a clear thumb.
Yes. But it wasn't matching anybody.
Okay.
So they start, you know, interviewing the Captain D's employees who had worked the night before. And they were saying around 10 o'clock that night, a man in a Shoney's apron showed up saying that he was wanting a new job. And the nighttime manager was like, you know, we're closing up. Come back in the morning. Talk to the daytime manager. But the National Police Headquarters detectives were showing photo lineups to three of the Captain D's workers, and they couldn't tell anybody. They were like, nope, none of these people. So a sketch artist came in and did, you know, a sketch from the person that they remember coming in for the application.
Yeah.
The detectives took it to Shoney's, and the manager at Shoney's was like, that looks like Paul Dennis Reed. And weirdly enough, he didn't come in on the morning of the 16th because he was having car trouble. They ran him through NCIC, came up negative, nothing. So fast forward to March 23rd, 1997. The McDonald's on Lebanon Road in Hermitage, Tennessee, had...
Hermitage.
How do you... Is that hermit... Hermitage?
Hermitage.
Hermitage.
We're too southern for this. Hermitage.
That McDonald's on Lebanon Road. A 27-year-old manager named Ronald Santiago and three other McDonald's workers who were Robert Sewell, so two Roberts, Jose Gonzalez, and Andrea Brown all clocked out for the evening. Santiago was going to unlock the side door. Everybody was walking out, and a man with a gun came in and herded them all back in.
That's normal, because if you've ever worked in fast food and closed up, you all come out the same door at the same time.
As they were going out, the man met him at the door. Yeah. I guess he probably knew that.
Probably walked.
Right. Yeah. As if he worked in a restaurant.
Mm.
So he herds them all back in. He took them straight to the back office near the back of the store. And he stole the money from the safe. And he took the entire group and put them in the dry storage room. And he executed them one by one.
Again?
Yes.
But this is such a large group of people.
Four.
Just two people.
Four people. Three of which were men. Well, when Gonzalez was about to be executed, all of a sudden the weapon misfired.
The gun jam.
He stood up and he started fighting him.
The man picked up a knife and stabbed him 17 times. He finally just fell to the floor and acted dead. So whenever the man fled from the scene, he actually crawled his way out and called 911.
Was the Gonzalez the last one that he was going to?
Yep. All the rest of them were dead. On the TV show that Yuri and I watched about this, you can hear the call. He's saying, "I don't speak English. Like, please, please," is all it's me saying. So the police get there. They get him to the hospital, and they're doing surgery on him. Actually, Andrea was still alive whenever the responders got on scene, but she ended up passing whenever she got to the hospital. Gonzalez was breathing, but he wasn't responsive, and they sent him to the hospital. Surgeons worked through the night, and they kept him alive. The next morning, Andrea was removed from life support. According to Gonzalez, the man who shot them all told each one of them bye.
Before he said bye, bang, bang. Mm-hmm.
Yes. There was no fingerprints again.
Again.
There was 6 Remington 25 caliber automatic shell casings, $2,300, mostly in coins.
Again, what the world's going.
Was missing. So this is looking really, really similar. And they were exactly 5 weeks apart.
Okay. So this is 1 a month.
Yes. Gonzalez was under lock and key 24/7 surveillance at Vanderbilt.
I'm sure he had guards at either end of that hallway.
The whole time. Yes. And he was able to come up with a sketch of a dark hair, mustache, baseball cap. And he was in really
good shape. That guy we saw at Capney's.
A lot the same, but just a little bit different.
1 and 1 equals 2.
Whenever they sat down and they started talking to Gonzalez, he was in such bad condition that, like, he had to start out by giving, like, sounds.
Like, almost shot. Then you fought for your life. Stabbed 17 times. Lord knows if he, like, tried to slit his throat or something.
Right. So by the time he was, like, this man is a badass. By the time he was able to give this description, he literally just had to, like, whisper it to the cops.
Wow. He was like, "You going down, buddy."
Right. On April 23rd, 1997, so now we're in April, at the Baskin-Robbins in Clarksville, Tennessee, Angela and Michelle were finishing up, leaving for the night. Angela was 21, and she was the night manager. At the Baskin-Robbins. Michelle was only 16 years old, and she was a high school student working part-time. Her brother was showing up around the same time to pick her up from work. He waited for about 15 minutes and he didn't see her. Finally goes looking through the windows. Front door is unlocked. He went inside and all the lights were off. No one was there. So he called 911. Police came in and found the top of the floor safe gone. He had came in and he had stolen the money and he had left. So at Dunbar Cave State Park on April 24th, a man walking his dog found the bodies of Michelle and Angela.
So these are the first ones that he's taken away. Is it because the Baskin-Robbins didn't have a big freezer to put them in?
That might be a good point.
Because, you know, they usually have, like, the ice cream freezer and then the case freezer.
And the Baskin-Robbins seems really, like, sketchy anyway, because they normally have, like, huge windows out
there. Yeah, they're, like, all windows.
Right. He had killed them pretty immediately because she was still in her Baskin-Robbins apron. The woman that was found had her hands bound behind her back. They searched the wood for clues, and about 100 feet away, they found the second victim. The second victim was Michelle Mace. Found in the water with her hands tied behind her back, wearing her Baskin-Robbins apron. And about 100 feet away in the woods, they had both been stabbed multiple times and their throats were slit. From what I understand, Angela, they found in the water. Watching that episode, she knew somebody that lived near there. So the police almost wonder if she took off running, trying to,
like, if I get out there, here,
right,
I can get to their house.
Right. So they think that's why they were found in the two different spots. At this time, the police actually started putting undercover officers into, like, fast food restaurants trying to catch this man because people were scared to death. I mean, this happened three different times. They actually started giving out stickers for people who worked in fast food restaurants to put in their windows of their cars. So when they would drive by,
what car
exactly
supposed to be there.
My husband was in Nashville at the time going to college. Like, people were terrified, and they started closing earlier and actually kind of implementing some safety measures that they didn't have otherwise. On June 1st, 1997, Mitchell Roberts was at home with his family, and he actually managed a Shoney's in that Nashville area.
Yeah.
It just so happens their family dog was going to have to get put down the next day. So his son, it was horrible. But the son had the video camera out and was sitting there in the living room recording it when Paul Dennis Reed came to their door. You can, like, see it on video. Him coming and trying to talk to Mitchell. Mitchell had actually fired Reed over him calling in for the Captain D's murders.
Right, when he didn't show up.
So then all of a sudden, like, this guy's just showing up at his house asking for his job back. And Mitchell's like, yo, I can't hire you back. Like, that's crazy.
Yeah, not up to me. Sorry.
And you can't just show up at my house and ask me that. This makes it inappropriate. Reed pulled a gun on him and he pulled handcuffs out of his pocket and instructed Mitchell to put them on and was like, hey, you're coming with me. And Mitchell was like, no, I'm not. Hurry back to the front door. And they didn't even have a gun. But Mitchell started screaming into his house and was like, honey, get the gun. It's right there. Grab it. Grab it. And Paul Dennis Reed was like, oh, shit, he has a gun. So he hightails it out of there. Mitchell called the police, obviously, because this was the craziest thing ever. Right after he calls the police, the phone rings. Who is it? Paul Reed.
What?
Calling to apologize to him. The police are at the house and Mitchell's like, you know, come on over here. We'll talk about it and we'll see what we can figure out from here. He shows up, the police are there, and they're like, why would you come back here? This is literally the dumbest idea ever.
Yeah.
At what point did any of this make sense to you?
Our guy, I don't think, is too smart.
He was taken into custody, and they booked him, and they interviewed him, but he tried to give him a false birthday. Like, you literally came back to us. You're not hard to prove who you are. So
No. What
are you doing? Mitchell actually is the one that told the police. He was like, dude, I think this dude is the fast food murderers.
Well, yeah, you think?
I don't think you need to let him go. And so they actually charged him with attempted kidnapping and aggravated assault. So then they call Jose Gonzalez. And they're like, okay, Jose, go through these pictures for us. He went over 300 pictures. It was like, this one right here. This is him.
Paul Reed?
Yes.
Shocking.
Well, you've got to remember, they also had that fingerprint off of the movie card.
Oh, yeah, that's true. So now they can compare that because they've got his ass booked.
Exactly.
With fingerprints.
They're like, well, let's go look in this man's apartment. They found 4 gallon jugs that had more than $1,000 in coins.
Well, and all the corn rolls are missing.
Right. Well, the white sneakers that had human blood on them, that also was a pretty big red flag, too.
Again, though. Our guy is not smart.
There was DNA from both the Baskin-Robbins employees. So obviously, they have him for that.
Mm-hmm.
And fibers from his car matched to Michelle and Angela. So they have him for that. They actually interrogated him for 8 hours, which he denied everything the whole time. So who was Paul Dennis Reed? He was born in Fort Worth, Texas, November 1957. And his dad was a raging alcoholic. His parents divorced when he was 3. He spent a lot of time with his paternal grandmother, and he actually was real fucking shitty to her. He would put tacks in her food. He would spray her with a water hose and barricade her in her room. One time, he tried to set her on fire while she was sleeping in her own bed.
What is wrong with you?
By the time he was 8 years old, he was sent to a home for boys. So you have to think that would have happened before he was 8 years old. By the time he was 16, neither one of his parents wanted him around because he tried to sexually assault both his mother and his sister.
Yeah, that's when you just go ahead. This is institutionalized, this person, please.
Well, mom sent him to live with dad's, and he did the same thing at his dad's house. So he was kicked out of that house and arrested for auto theft, already getting in trouble with the law, making bad decisions from a very young age. He got 3 years probation for that auto theft charge. He just got even more into the life of crime, and the auto theft charge was the least of his worries. He ended up getting robberies, check fraud, more auto theft. Really didn't give a shit about anything.
Yeah. Sound like a real stand-up guy.
In April of 1984, he was sentenced to 20 years behind bar for robbing restaurants and a hardware store. He gave the advice to fellow inmates, cut your hair and dress nice so people won't suspect you. And next time, I won't leave any witnesses.
Oh, so he has a prior conviction for it. Oh, yeah, because this was 97.
This was 1984. And he was supposed to have a 20-year sentence.
How?
Yeah.
How is this man out on the street?
Well, while he was in jail, he assaulted hospital and prison staff. He claimed mental abuse and mind control by the government.
Again, how is this man walking the street?
Despite being labeled dangerous and a potential menace to society, Reed was paroled in 1990.
They said, oh, we just don't want anything to do with him anymore. Yeah.
He moved around from Texas and Oklahoma all the way up to Illinois. And he's actually suspected of molesting multiple children of both girlfriends and family during this time, even though there's no proof of it.
I hate this man.
So less than a year out, he became a truck driver. While he was a truck driver, he got into a horrific accident. And he got 2 years of workman's comp, so they gave him 25,000.
These are the first people this man has killed.
No. No.
No.
And he had just $25,000, too. So what did he decide to do with that $25,000? Get plastic surgery. He gets a skin pill. He gets dental work to straighten his teeth. Why, you may ask? To be a country western singer.
Can he sing?
No. Oh, no. Like, that, they play a little clip, and I mean, he can sing, but it sounds like any man you've ever heard in a bar anywhere that you blink your eyes around here singing a Garth Brooks song. That's just what he sounds like. He just, not enough to get a record deal.
That's for sure.
He moved to Nashville, and in September of 1995, he started calling himself Justin Parks, dressing in a cowboy hat, boots, and blue jeans.
Oh.
And within a month, he was working as a cook in a local restaurant, because what else do you do when you're trying to make it in the Music City?
And you ain't gonna.
Well, that's probably why he turned to armed robbery pretty quickly. But you remember, when he was in prison, he said he would never leave witnesses next time. When Paul Reed went on trial for the fast food murders, he was actually tried three separate times.
For the three separate robberies?
Yes. His defense said that his head injuries that he suffered throughout life had rendered him with, literally, they said, a broken brain.
No, no.
They also said that he had paranoid schizophrenia, some symptoms of psychosis, and that basically he can't tell that he's sick. Well, the prosecution said the proof was actually established that approximately like 8 to 10 weeks before the crimes, a man named Robert sold the defendant the gun, two of them. One was nickel-plated with black handle grips, and the other one was nickel-plated with pink handles. And he actually said that he gave him a box of ammunition as part of, like, the transaction. And the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation, TBI officer, actually ended up proving that the ammunition that that man had given him with the gun was what was used in all of the crimes.
So it was all... all from that box?
Yeah.
Okay.
So Danny Tack said that in January 1997, he overheard Paul saying that he was having like bad financial difficulties and that he was going to start robbing restaurants at nighttime, and had actually asked this man if he knew where to get a gun from.
Because this idiot talked to people about
it. Because he actually said this to another coworker named Jeffrey and told Jeffrey that robbery was an easy way to make money. A little bit about each of the trials that he had. For Captain D's, Steve Hampton's driver's license and a video rental card were the ones that had the fingerprints on each, and that is what convicted him on two counts of first-degree murder for Captain D's. For McDonald's, Jose actually identified Reed in court, and he was, like, obviously the key evidence because he was still there, and he knew what was happening. For the Baskin-Robbins murders, Reed's car was found to contain forensic evidence from the victims, evidence of a credit card gasoline purchase near the location of the bodies the night of the murder.
Mm-hmm.
He was in an area room 40 miles away from his home for that, so why else would you be there unless that's what you were doing?
Right.
And blood evidence was found on his shoes. He was found guilty on two counts of first-degree murder. In addition to his 7 murder convictions, he was also convicted on multiple counts of aggravated robbery, aggravated kidnapping. And jurors were actually brought in from East Tennessee and West Tennessee and sequestered so that nobody that had heard about the case in like Middle Tennessee
right.
would have a bias.
There's no bias.
His original trial was the first murder trial to be broadcast live in the state of Tennessee.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so we all wanted him to fry.
Yes. He received 7 death sentences for his conviction.
Well, there it is. Was it uphill?
It has been stayed several times since then, including in 2003, just hours before. He had one more after that, but he died in prison November 1st, 2013, of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease and pneumonia. His 7 death sentences are the most ever handed to a single person in the state of Tennessee.
Well, he deserved it.
As a result of Reed's spree, several fast food restaurants in the area began closing earlier. There was police patrol. The city of Mount Juliet, Tennessee began, you know, the stickers that I was talking about that everybody had to keep in their windows. And this really shook the Nashville area for a time.
It sounds like it. I mean, I would be terrified.
Yeah. 7 people just working their job every day just to do it.
For money.
Yep.
So that, and I think this man was just psychotic to begin with, you know?
Yeah. He had a broken brain.
Broken brain. Yeah. That is the most horseshit excuse I ever heard.
Yeah, I mean, that doesn't... I've had a head injury, and I've never killed anybody.
There you go.
There you go. Thanks, guys.
Don't whistle in the woods at night.
Bye, y'all.